travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guest is Matt Hawkins. You know him as the COO of Top Cow Comic Books. He's now the writer of Colossus, which is based on the song from the Clay People. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Hawkins. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure, sir. I'm a big fan of yours and a big fan of Top Cow Comic Books.
Well, I appreciate that. I might have a special guest joining me here. Apologies. He won't say no for he won't take no for an answer. The cat is the cat, you know.
You know, all pets are welcome on the show. My dog may jump in at any moment, so totally understandable. So you've been the president and COO of Top Cow Publishing for almost 25 years.
Yep.
What is the chief operating officer? What does it do exactly? And in your opinion, what has been the key to Top Cow's success for almost three decades?
Well, chief operating officer is more a board of directors title. All that really means is I'm on the board of directors. I mean, my main, you know, in a smaller company, you don't have such defined roles with CEO, CEO, CTO, and stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, there's really only Mark and I on the executive team. So that's it. So, you know, I'm the president and COO. He's the CEO. All the other titles we don't really have are taken. But, you know, for the most part, I deal with the operations, the finance, the legal, copyright, trademark, you know, so I do with a lot of the business and the finance and the legal and the licensing. That's stop it.
So all the fun stuff you handle, it sounds like.
Well, I mean, I get to write comics too, you know,
so that's
fun. I do enjoy that. But the business is the business, you know, it's honestly, it's not that different from most other businesses. There are a few things that are proprietary to comics. I think the one unique thing about Top Cow is it is the only, I believe, company still owned and run by creatives. That's a comic book publisher, you know, that was founded and run. Because Mark and I run the company, and he's an artist and I'm a writer. You know, we both deal with the business on a daily basis. So, and to the latter question about what do I attribute the success of Top Cow? Pivoting, fast movement, you know, I mean, Mark Silvestri, you know, I mean, the guy's a Hall of Famer, legend. The company would be nothing without him. And he's created an environment where we've allowed a lot of artists to flourish, and creativity and creators are more important at Top Cow than the business people. And I think that matters.
You know, because especially the world of comic book, there's so much turnover. You know, companies come and go so quickly in the industry. You know, I would say maybe 3-5 years tends to be the limit. But Top Cow has had a steady existence and one of actual, you know, impact. I mean, the characters that come out of Top Cow have survived the collective consciousness of the comic book industry, like I said, for all those years. And that's a testament to both of you guys, I think, and how well you guys have done.
Well, thank you for that. I think a lot of it is, you know, Mark had a very specific goal and mission with Top Cow. He wanted to keep it small, boutique, artist heavy, you know, with very talented creative and sort of wanted to create a more boutique publisher. Whereas so many other companies have gone from a 4-title line to a 10-20 title line. I could argue that that's the reason why Valiant has sort of had problems both times, because when they launched, both companies had a small line of very good books that everyone liked. And then when you expand from 4 really quality books to 10, you know, it's hard to maintain that quality. And then you expand to 20, it's impossible. So, that's why, you know, you get a company like Marvel and DC that has 100 titles a month. You know, I mean, how many of them are good?
It's
an objective question. I think the thing is, for us at Top Cow, we believe that every one of our books is good. Now, you can argue with us on that, but we are making and publishing and writing and drawing the books we want to do. You know, and I think that's the beauty of honestly, one of the things I love about my job and getting up every day is I get to get up and create stuff I want to create. You know, and I get paid to do it. I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, when you're talking about comic book companies that expand too quickly, I think in my head, the one that kind of stands out to me is always Cross-Gen Comic Books that had some beautiful comic books in the, I think it's the early 2000s, late 90s, but eventually they came out, they started spreading so quickly that they actually started chewing their own audience.
Yeah.
Eventually, no, they devour themselves.
So many companies have done that. I mean, it's not just Cross-Gen. Cross-Gen is notorious, and Cross-Gen, by the way, pretty much decided and stole Top Cow's model up until they expanded to 10, 20 titles a month. I mean, the guy who ran that company, Mark Alessi, tried to hire 2/3 of the people from Top Cow. So, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the other thing that I think Top Cow does that's unique to Top Cow, and I think cannot be overestimated by how fantastic of a thing that it is a top cow talent search that you guys do every year. And very few companies pay that kind of attention to the writers.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, and as a, someone who wants to be a writer myself, there's almost no company that will look at just the writer. You know, everyone wants the, you know, the artist team to look at their book. So I think that's incredible what you guys do. So what inspired the idea for that search?
Well, it's been an art search. The first Top Cow talent hunt was in 1994 or five, I think it was. It was through Wizard Magazine. You know, it was before I even worked there. And I remember it was only for artists. And then when I started, there was another art contest. And I think Top Cow did it on its own, 98, 99. It was right when I first started. And it was also just for artists. About 10 years later, I was talking to Mark and we said, you know, we could use some new art talent, some young people we could build up. So we decided to do the art contest again. And honestly, the writers was an add-on. I just threw it out there to Mark. I said, you know what, if we add a writing component, there's just not really a lot of opportunities for writers to break in, you know? Mm. And he's like, yeah, you know, if you want to read them. I mean, that's essentially what it was. I mean, he's fine with it. I mean, I get Ryan Cady, I used to get Brian Hill, and there's a couple guys that I get that help me read all those, but I have to read most of these things. And every year I do it, and every year when I get done reading it, I always in my mind say, this is the last time I'll ever do this. And then in about 3 to 6 months, what happens is one of the winners from this contest usually is like a Teeny Howard or a Isaac Goodhart or, you know, one of these people like Ben Kahn. I mean, the Top Cow Talent Hunt is brought in 10, 15, 20 people that are currently working in the comic book industry in various, you know, capacities. And I think the more interesting thing I think about the Top Cow Talent Hunt is we're actually doing it now, not to bring people into Top Cow, just to give them an opportunity. Because most of these people that have come through, we don't have work for them. You know what I mean? I mean, we don't have enough work to give them on top of the work that we're doing. So in a weird way, it is kind of, we're just doing it to try to give people a hand out, a leg up. I mean, we benefit from it. It certainly gets us a lot of views online and it gets, you know, people read the books. And I certainly do target it. Obviously, we're doing Cyberforce this year as the talent hunt. We're also releasing the Cyberforce hardcover. It's the 30th anniversary. So there's certainly a marketing windfall for us doing this. But I got to tell you, it's a cross between a labor of love and a pain in the ass. And and honestly, it's the people, you know, the people that you deal with on it, they're either fantastic or they're awful, you know, and there's really no in between, you know, and for the 1 out of 10, that's kind of awful. It's just, it's difficult to, it makes you not want to do it at all. And then I have to remind myself about the other 9, you know, and I'm like, these people are good people. They're trying, they're doing it the right way. Just because this one idiot over here is you know, trying, and I just get tired of people trying to break the rules, you know what I mean, and it's just I've spent, like I said, this is the 7th talent hunt we've done. Okay, so the rules document that I've written and adjusted every year is pretty ironclad and airtight, meaning it's very clear what we want, how to do it, how it's to be accepted. There's very little question anyone can ask that is not answered in this document. But I have a Facebook group where I tell people they can ask questions and they can talk. And I tell people in there and I post documents. And there's an active Facebook. It's got over 5,000 people in it. I mean, it's active right now. If you want to join it, you can.
Oh, I already am in the group.
Oh, you are? Yeah. Well, then you see some of the, you know, when I started initially, it was just open to anyone posting. And then I would go in and take posts down. I didn't realize. And my Lisa, our marketing girl, told me that, oh, you know, you can set that to where they need your approval. And that kind of ended it. But, you know, I set up the rules for the group. And, you know, the biggest problem I have is it's intended specifically for this function. But a lot of people go on there and they try to post a million other things. Like, if you want to go in there and talk about Russia and Ukraine. I'm like,
right.
So many places to talk about that. And I'm talking about that. I'm not talking about it in a Top Cow Talent Hunt group. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, right.
I mean, it has a function. It has a purpose. And so you've seen, you have no idea how many times I get IMs from, because you don't see my IMs. I get hundreds of IMs on Facebook of people asking me these inane questions that are answered and the rules. It just drives me up, man. And this is the first year where I've kind of not been a dick about it, but I've just said, it's in the rules document. Go reread it.
Yeah.
I have that now. I've written that 100 times.
Yeah. I'm in the group and I always like to check and see, because with the group, you see a lot of people, they post their art and some of their other stuff. And perhaps to see what they're doing. I will admit, I never submitted anything to the talent search, but I always like to be in the group and keep an eye on what's going on. Because as an indie creator myself, I like seeing what's out there. And and I just think it's a such a wonderful service to do, especially like I said, from a writer perspective, because like I said, as someone who looks through the different companies and what looking for submissions, it's never I'm looking for writing. You know, it's never can I see a script? Is and I get it. I mean, art is easier to view and see the quality of than a piece of writing, which the labor that you must be going through to read 100, 200 submissions must be insane.
Oh, we had 1,100 writers.
1,100. Jesus
1,100
Christ.
Last time. There was 1,100. Now, I only read 100 of those. The rest of them were read by Ryan and Brian and other people. But I read all the ones. Anyone I met at a convention or anyone I know personally at all, I tell them to flag me and I will read theirs. Because if I run into them again, I'll at least talk to them about it. And, you know, we used to do feedback. I don't know if you remember that from a couple of these ago. And I stopped doing that because I got tired of arguing with people.
They'd argue with you?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing. People are writing stories based on our characters and they're arguing with me about it. And I just get tired of that. I don't have time for that. You know what I mean? I don't need to justify our decisions to someone. You know, I mean, I can, I should be able to.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of times when people, they ask really weird stuff. And the thing that irritates me so much, honestly, is when people write stuff intentionally to be the first issue of like 100 episode or 100 arc, because they, because in their mind, I even wrote this specifically in the rules, don't do this, because it's done so often, because people will write these things expecting that we'll fall in love with it and want to work with them for the next 25 years. And what happens is in every instance that goes in a no pile. Every instance. Because the rules very clearly say write a self-contained one-shot story that doesn't influence continuity.
Mm.
It's not that hard. You know, I mean you could pick at anything. And I tell people all the time the key to that is to find one emotional hook. It's all you need.
Mm. And you know, and I totally agree with that. And I think the funniest thing is that people are arguing with you, not only because you're, you know, I mean they're when the heads of Top Cow, you know the characters, but too, as any person who tries to be professional, the moment you try arguing with the person who critiqued your work, you've already lost. You've already lost not only the argument, but face as well, because it's not your job to argue your piece at all. If someone doesn't like it, they don't. You listen to the advice and you either take it or you don't. But the argument to me is always the sign of lack of professional, unprofessionalism right off the bat, in my opinion.
I agree, and I don't want to work with those people because life's too short. You know, it's also anyone that's incredibly angry and constantly trashing everything on their social media. I don't want to work with them either.
Mm.
You know, life's too short, man. I don't want to work with someone who's intensely negative. Also, one of the things I see sometimes is, and I'm not saying these things aren't necessarily valid, but Twitter is the wrong place to do it, where I'll see people criticizing other publishers, you know, that they worked with or worked for. And I'm like, God, this needy cat. He will not leave me alone. sorry. But I'm sorry. I didn't mean to go on a rant. I just happened before we hopped on this to go through and answer a bunch of these questions. And one of them irritated me so much, man. The problem is people come and they ask for feedback, but they don't want feedback. They want validation. Mm. They want a job. And most people are unrealistic at their skill level. And especially artists. I found that artists seem to be far more, by the way, which shocks me, it would seem to be that the writers would be a little more oblivious to their skill level, because it's much easier to argue that, whereas something that's drawn clearly has a component that's easier to assess. But we get these artists all the time that think they're amazing and they're not. And I don't know what to do with these people, you know? I mean, it's just... My best advice, you want to break into the comic industry, if you want to work for another publisher and you don't want to just do it on your own, be humble, respectful, self-deprecating, and be on time and be punctual and be prepared to wait, because I'm in no hurry to help you get your career started.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm not. I have a full-time job. I write full-time. I have two cats, two kids. You know, I got a lot going on. I got my own projects.
Right.
So when people expect, you know, me to drop everything to help them out, you know, I tell people sometimes it might be months. People ask me all the time to read their stuff, and I will do it. But I tell people sometimes it might be months before I can get to it. And that's not because I'm lazy. It's because I don't have the time.
Right.
You know, I really, you know.
You know, I kind of.
Touch the nerve, man.
No, I appreciate that 100%. Because, you know, and I can totally get it from your perspective. And I think maybe the problem with art is I consider it the high school problem, or at least what I call the high school problem, which is, there's a difference between good in high school and good in profession, you know, in a profession where in your little world of high school, your art, you may be the best artist or a great artist. I was like, oh my God, how wonderful you are. But that's a different pool than when you go into the real world. And I think
you could be the best artist from that high school in the last 100 years and right. still not be able to provide some quality comics.
Right. And I think that's the problem. People get lose perspective because they're like, oh, well, everyone in high school, the teacher said I was wonderful. It's like, right, for your high school. You know, and I must admit, and I have taught in high school for a while myself, and I listen to some people talk to some of the students, and they're like, oh, the person is a genius. And it's like, for the school. You know, it's like, keep that in mind. And I think that's probably why people lose perspective. And as a writer, I think you lose perspective because very few people read your stuff. I mean, the amount of people who've looked at your own stuff, I call it, in my opinion, I call it the void. You're writing in a void, you know? And I guess it's hard to view everyone else when you're writing your own void.
Yeah. No, and it's just, you know, and this is the problem. This is the thing I have a hard time explaining to people is because so few people on my end of this, what I will call a gatekeeper, because I hire people to write comic books. So I could be a gatekeeper to give you a career. Is how, you know, there's so few of us willing to actually talk to any of these people at all. Because it is really annoying sometimes, and it's very difficult. And I actually will talk to people and tell them, you know, how I feel for the most part. And then, like I said, the people want to argue with me, and that's when the second they start arguing with me, I'm done. I will say, hey, you know, go self-publish, prove me wrong.
I agree.
No, I'm serious. And people have. I've seen some people prove me wrong, and they've emailed me, and all I say is, hey, proud of you.
Well, I think that's the best thing, as well for you. I mean. Once again, everything's subjective. You can't, there's no, you know, when something is subjective, you shouldn't argue it anyway, you know?
Right.
And I've written a few comic books that I've gotten reviews on that were negative. And it's, you know, it takes a few hours to kind of, you know, get back up, but you just go, thank you very much. And you move on with your day.
Therein is a mistake. Just so you know, I have not read a single comic book review of anything I've done in over the last decade.
Oh, really?
Because they're useless. You know, I mean, they don't affect sales at all. And often, I just say, you know, they're not useless. I mean, they have value because we pull quotes off of them and then we put them on books and you know, and a lot of people are very complimentary. I just, it's just fascinating to me. And I have to tell you, the one that really irks me was Sunstone, because here's suddenly Top Cow's best-selling book of all time. And I have people giving it negative reviews, but they're giving it because they don't like the content. Not because they don't like the book. They don't think it's professional. They dislike the morality of the content. Mm. Therefore, they're going to torpedo it. It's like when Mike Miller is a guy who is a YouTuber, and he did a review of one of my swing books that I did, and he eviscerated it. And I consider the guy a friend of mine, but he eviscerated it because he's a Christian and he didn't like the content. Mm. And I, you know, whatever. You know, it is what it is.
Well, I will say one thing that is prevalent now in the world of comic books, unfortunately, or fortunate or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, is that people have now made it into political sides have now existed. I mean, I'm not going to go into the group who I really dislike. I'm not even going to mention them. I'm sure you know who I'm talking about. who can't stand any kind of cultural group that's not in a very specific singular group. I'm not, like, I won't go into the name of that group, but
I get it,
you know.
But just, you know what, honestly, I'm 52 now. I'm a little older, so maybe people that are younger don't feel this, but I don't have time for anger and conflict anymore, you know. I just don't, and I don't really feel like fighting with people when I'm trying to help them, you know. And so I'm gonna help the people that are willing and receptive, and I'm gonna ignore the people that aren't.
Well, I will say, as someone who things are highly of Top Cow for doing the talent search, don't quit because people suck. Keep going on the talent search. Personally, it's personal request. Don't quit. Like I said, there's someone who you're helping out there in a big way, I think.
We won't quit. We don't do it. Everyone calls it the annual hunt, but we actually do it every other year. Because it takes a year to do it, and it takes a year to honestly collect it, get it done, and do it. So it's every other year we've done it. This is the fifth one, so that we've been doing this for 10 years.
Well, like I said, I think they're awesome. And so just to pivot slightly, your newest project, which what we're talking about as well, is Colossus, which is brilliant from what I've been able to read. And
Thank you.
And as someone who is Jewish as well, it's great to see a Jewish character in the comic books. And someone talking about the culture, I think it's fantastic. So what was the inspiration for Colossus?
Just to clarify, Colossus is, the title is The Clay People: Colossus. because of a certain X-Men character. but that was honestly, I asked them if they just changed the name, but they wanted to keep it because of as the title of the song, you know. So we're doing it as a one-shot comic. It's not going to be continued. I don't think there's any legal issues. We've not heard anything from Marvel. I don't, you know, having that full title, I think it separates it anyway. But no, it's you know, it's kind of loosely based on one of my sons and my own life, and the Jewish component I added in to make the golem work, because I just thought the golem was cool. Yes. You know, truth is, I learned about the golem myth from that X-Files episode, Kadesh. The only reason I know the name of the episode is because I went back and rewatched it when I was started doing this book. I really quite enjoyed it. I didn't know anything about Kabbalah at that point. Everyone heard about Madonna and all that stuff after that, but it was sort of that. I believe that episode of X-Files kind of got Kabbalah known, at least to me. That was the first time I'd ever even heard of it. So I started, you know, reading some books and doing some stuff. And Rich Leibowitz, who is the guy who owns and runs Epitome, which is a video game company that also does comics and stuff, they had the rights to the Clay People's song Colossus. And I've been working with Rich on a number of things. And he asked if I'd be interested in writing a one-off on this song. And, you know, honestly, initially I said no. And I'm not a heavy metal guy, so I wasn't familiar with the band or the material. But he said, just take a look. And then I watched the video. And the video online is like, it's got Godzilla and Kaiju and all. I don't know if you've watched it, but it's completely unlike what I did in the comic. And I knew we couldn't do anything with Kaiju and Godzilla because these are, you know, again, we're already named. We want to keep it as clean as possible. So I started thinking about, well, what else is big and Colossus like? And then I don't know why, but the golem from the Jewish myth popped in my head. And then I just kind of wrote that. I wrote the outline for that story in about an hour. And,
oh, wow.
It's almost completely faithful to that. Rich, who, like I said, hired me, helped me. I talked and interviewed a couple rabbis and got kind of their opinions on a few things. I was a little shocked in my research. And I have to say, I feel like I'm a student of religion and I probably know more about Judaism than most, but I was shocked at how little I knew once I started doing this research. You know what I mean? I mean, I was genuinely shocked, you know. And then when I got into kind of how modern rabbinical thought is on revenge, and they consider it very not Jewish. You know, they said revenge and vengeance, these are not things that are Jewish. And which is interesting because the whole concept of the story I was telling was about revenge. but I hope that it works because it's a teenage kid, you know, 13, 14, however old he is, just got his bar mitzvah money. You know, he's passionate. And it's a fictional, you know, story. I don't believe that these golems are real. And I don't think any rabbis do either. It was intended as a story to embolden the Jews of Poland when they were being, you know, prejudiced against, whatever you want to call it, anti-Semitic, even in that time period. It was intended to embolden them as a people. And it worked. But I always loved the supernatural stuff. You know, I've yet to in my lifetime ever see anything that would qualify as supernatural to where I would say, oh, that's real, you know, but I'm still waiting. So I'm waiting for my ghost or, you know, something.
Well, like I said, and I really also was fascinated with the story of the golem as well. And I do like the, you know, reading the folklore on it. And, you know, it very much to me, it was a parable on the dangers of solving violence with violence. Because it is, depending on the story, because I know there's multiple versions of the golem story that have existed. But one of the issues tends to be is that the golem is a creature that at some point loses the danger is losing control of the golem and the danger that could cause. So obviously that's why they kind of shut it down, or however word they phrase for it, but basically shut it down.
Right.
So in your story with the Colossus is, I know the main character is the boy, is right. When the danger's the Colossus itself.
No, that's not the way I wrote it. You know, I mean, it's not written that way. Have you read the preview of the full book?
I only had the preview. I didn't get the full book.
I'll send you the full book. It'll make more. I think you should read the full book. I shouldn't tell you more. I'll send you the full book link after this. You can give it a read. And if you want to add, you know, comments after that, you can. You know, 'cause you said you're going to record video. So, but I'm just, I wrote it in a very specific way for a specific purpose. It might be a little too linear for that reason, but it opened up a lot of interesting story ideas for me. And there's Because initially I just thought of this as a one-off thing, you know, and but then once I wrote this and started developing it out and building out these characters, I started having a ton of ideas. It's the same thing that happened to me with Think Tank. You know, when I wrote Think Tank, it was intended as a one-off, and then I really liked it, and other people liked it, and suddenly I was able to sell, and then it sold more, and then we went color, and here I am 15 years later.
So Colossus, well, the Clay People Colossus, is going to expand beyond a one shot. You're going to make it, it's going to go become a continuing story, perhaps?
It could. I mean, that's not the thing with that is it's based on a heavy metal band's lyrics. So I don't own those. And I kind of did this with them in conjunction to develop this out. So, I mean, we'd have to work that out. I mean, I'm not, I usually don't do this much work for hire work. You know what I mean? Mm. Most of the stuff I create is original stuff that I and Takao own. And we leverage. And so this third party work for hire stuff is usually not, you know, that's why I don't go write a 50 issue arc for some company book. That's not what we do.
Now, as you said, the Clay People's music is, I think it's classified as industrial metal. Was there importance, any importance played on the tone of the comic book to match the tone of the lyrics?
Yes. In fact, when I first read through the lyrics and then I came up with a story idea, I actually called and spoke with the guy who wrote the song. And I asked him how much of the song had to do with addiction. And he said all of it. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so we had a long chat. So I believe the story I wrote is very faithful to their lyrics, very faithful to their lyrics. And the intent of it, that sort of unline and sublimating the story and the song. You know, the song, you know, I mean, I think like a lot of art and entertainment, there's a top layer, you know, where it's all the single ladies, you know, or whatever, you know, whatever it is, it's the layer. And then if it's good entertainment, there's a layer beneath that, you know, I mean, and any arguable TV show or movie or anything that has long lasting, I think, taps into that. And that's one of the things I really, that's probably been my favorite thing as an aging creator is I now I'm able to look at other entertainment and stories and kind of review them with a more of a critical eye. And that's allowed me to see a lot deeper intent with what the creators and the art. And I gotta tell you, that's one of the things I love about my job is I can reach out to most of these people and they'll respond to me, novel writers, filmmakers, you know, actors. Yeah. And because, you know, what happens to comics, they get turned into movies. So, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'll say that's what I love about doing the podcast is that I can read something or hear about something and be like, I'm going to reach out to that guy, and I can actually have the conversation about the thing I enjoyed. And it's a cool feeling. It's you know, just being able to reach out to the person you're interested in and be like, hey, I'll talk to you. Tell me about what you did, you know?
And that's great for podcasts, and it's great for a guy like me with jobs where I'm always looking for content. But, you know, that's the one cool thing I think about comic book creators, too, is you can go to a comic book convention and not just meet and get an autograph and take a picture, but you can actually talk to us. You know, like if you go see William Shatner, how long is that experience really? Is it 15 seconds?
Usually if shorter.
Is it shorter than 15 seconds? I don't even know. I mean, I've never paid for one of those, but people are paying hundreds of dollars to essentially get an autograph and take a photo with their favorite celebrity, which is cool. I'm not dissing that at all. But, you know, you go to a comic convention and find a comic creator at his table and talk to him for half an hour if you want. And really talk to him about his work, her work, and get into it. And, you know, it's why I think Zach Kaplan, one of the creators I work with a lot, he and I were talking about this. He said, you have your 10,000 fans, Matt. I'm like, what does that mean? He's like, oh, you built a core audience of your work. And I'm like, that's true. You know, because I don't really worry about putting a book out anymore that it won't make money. You know what I mean? Like, I used to stress about that 20 years ago. It stressed me out a lot. If I wrote a book or created a book that came out and lost money, you know, I was a failure, you know, But that hasn't happened in a long time.
Zach Kaplan, I look forward to, we interview him the end of March. He's, I can look forward to reading his book too.
Metal Society, by the way, best thing he's ever done. Love that book. It is hands down my favorite thing he's ever done. I believe this book, if stores tripled their orders, they'd be under ordering.
Well, I'll definitely have to ask for the preview copy. It's always easier when you get the preview copy because you can ask the deeper questions about the project. Right. Now, one cool thing about Colossus, the story begins in 1945 Germany. And obviously anyone who knows history knows what that means to the Jewish people. And then it segues to the modern times, which is the protagonist, which is a biracial boy who's getting bullied. And I kind of thought about the connections there between kind of like a timelessness of hatred that kind of goes on, that even though it might not, it's not obviously not the to the extreme of, you know, the Holocaust, which is obviously a greater extreme, but it still shows that even in the 21st century, there's hatred still connects people, you know, there's a connection of hatred that goes through generations. Now, was that like an intentional connection that you were trying to make between hatred now and hatred back then, or at least the beginnings of hatred now to what was back then?
It was more meant, I think, for me to say that I think that stuff is just evergreen. You know what I mean? It's always with us. You know, I mean, you know, we go back, you look at anti-Semitic thought and writings, and you go back to pogroms. I mean, they're as far back as you can remember, you know. And it's always amazing to me when I educate Christians that are, you know, in my family or friends that will listen to me and actually listen to me and not just, you know, tune me out. But I'll explain to them part of the reason why Christians dislike Jews is because in the early Catholic Church, the Catholic Church outlawed usury and said that no Christian can make interest on a loan. And that they got rid of that by, the, I don't remember when it was. But so what did they do? They reached out to the Jewish community and said, hey, will you be our bankers and our money launderers and not money launderers, money takers, what changers, whatever. And so that is part of the history of why that happened. So you flash forward and you look at Hitler, you know, I mean, and he's like, we're going to unify the German speaking people of the world. Does that sound like something Putin said today? We're going to unify the Russian speaking people of the world. You know, he said that and, you know, he's just nuts, you know, and goes out there and just, and he blamed the Jews for ripping off everything. And I don't know. It's just mind numbing to me. And man, I have to tell you, it's shocking to me how much anti-Semitism has risen of late. You know, I mean, a lot, you know, and like I said, my sons are half Asian. Both my wives are Asian, you know, so I have a strong ties to the Asian community, and the Asian hate I've not seen in my lifetime, really. Is frightening to me, man. I mean, you know, and this Russia-Ukraine thing scares the crap out of me, and I'm shocked that most people don't seem to care right now. I mean, it's all over the news, but man, you look at social media, no one's talking about it.
And you know, I agree with you in so many areas over there. I mean, as someone, like I said, who's Jewish myself, I say, when I've talked to people, you know, about racism and stuff like that, and I say, there's something about being Jewish is often you can blend in. And, you know, no one knows you're Jewish unless you say something about it. But every so often, and sometimes because of that, it's easy sometimes to forget how much anti-Semitism is out there until you get hit with it. You're like, oh, you know, it's like a reminder. No, it's still there. You know, it's still ever present. I still remember in high school being asked if I had a tail, you know, because of that old stereotype of Jews having tails. And, you know, and it's just fascinating how some of the stuff that you think is gone now just simmers out just enough. You're like, just a reminder. It's not gone. You're still, you know, it's still there. But it's fascinating.
It's generationally, perpetrated. You know, you had fathers putting it on their sons. And I am kind of shocked because if you go to my grandfather, who was a World War II Midway, he fought at Midway. He's a Navy pilot, storied, decorated, naval veteran, was probably one of the most racist people I'd ever known. You know, and I grew up as a little kid. He was in Wichita, Kansas. And my dad was not like that. And he raised us differently. And I've often wondered how that happened, because it is really kind of this generational thing where you'll see that people just, you know, apple doesn't fall far from the tree. People tend to become their parents, you know? I'm frustrated with people because it just seems to me that everyone is so stupid now. It feels like critical thinking in this country has gone away. And people just want their echo chamber that makes them feel better, and you know, damn the reality. And I'm not taking a side, left, right, center. It's not even that. It's all of the above. Everyone's doing it. And that lack of reality, you know, I mean, I don't want to turn this into a political thing, but it's just frustrating to me, you know, because I have a lot of thoughts on these things. I have a lot. Yeah. And I would love to share them and have intense, deep conversations with people that disagree with me. But the problem is the second I come out and question something that might be cherished on the left or the right, that group then attacks me. You know what I mean? And with cancel culture the way it is and these things, there's no point in even taking a position. Unless you're someone who wraps yourself in that position and that flag and is able to use that to garner, you know, money, you know, people that will buy your books, then people are buying your book because they're supporting a cause. They're not buying your book because they want to read your book.
Yeah, I agree 100%. But I would say I would imagine the American ignorance is consistent with the past. It's just that because of social media, you just can hear, everyone can voice it now, where luckily, you know, 30 years ago, when someone was being had some dumbass ideas, no one heard about them because they didn't have a voice, you know, to speak it. But yeah, it is amazing. It's interesting that it feels like it's become much stronger and more prevalent over the last, I would say, 20 years, where yeah. everyone's issue, you know, everything has become just, passion might not be the right word, but definitely more fiery. It's probably
well, the thing is, word. The reality is, it used to be the National Enquirer, and there were a few publications of that ilk where you got even some of the kooky theories put out, and there were like fanzines and stuff like that. The problem is, every moron can post up their treaties on Twitter now or on Facebook. Mm. And so everyone is seeing their words in print.
Yeah.
There used to be people who would only have editors and journalists, you know, when there was some integrity to the world, where stuff was, you know, there was a filtering process that went to things people thought to what people actually read.
Mm.
And that was a superior system, because the one we have now is deeply flawed, troubling, and I believe could end the human existence.
Well, I will say I don't envy the new generation. Like I said, as a high school teacher, I get, you know, all my students, you know, they've grown up with social media, and the amount of stress they talk about social media, or someone hasn't liked their stuff, or, you know, and all that shit. I'm just like, my God, I'm glad I didn't have to deal with that shit when I was in school. Where, yeah. You know, you leave school and then you leave school. These kids like never leave. I mean, if there are kids who got bullied or anything else, they take that shit home with them, because they're getting bullied online. They're getting bullied at school. They never get to leave. It's a scary future. It's a very scary future.
Well, and that's one of the things I thought about the bullying, because the bullying I received as a kid when I was a kid was mainly because I was always the new kid. And yeah, part of that was probably me, because I had a chip on my shoulder because I didn't care, you know. And when you go to a place like in the middle of Missouri, my dad was stationed at Whiteman Air Force Base in the middle of Missouri. And we lived in a town called Warrensburg, which had a very small population. And I'd never lived in a town that small. Honestly, that period of time where I lived there in 1980 to 1984 was the inspiration for both Postal and some of these other things, where I got the ideas for some of these, because you live in these rural environments. It's so different. Mm. And people just think differently. And, you know, you meet people like when we lived in Cheyenne. I lived in Cheyenne, Wyoming from 1976 to 1979. And there were people there that had never left the city, let alone the state. Like, you go to Cheyenne and people are like, oh, you know, I've never been outside of Cheyenne. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, my dad was in the military, so we moved states every 2 or 3 years, you know, so the idea of never having left a single town was insane to me. My mom's mother never went more than, I think it was 30 miles from the place she was born.
Oh, wow. You know, I will say one of the nice things, important things I think in life is travel. I think living in South Carolina, I live in Rhode Island now, but I moved down to South Carolina for a couple of years to work for a job. It opened my eyes so much to the realities of the world, just being that far. I mean, there's stories of, I lived in a predominantly white neighborhood, and the stories, you know, finding out the realities of racism there, because we had an African-American, you know, in the area. And the amount of crap I would hear, because they would talk to me about it, I'm just like, Jesus Christ, it's not. And when you live in Warwick, Rhode Island, you can kind of, the racism doesn't seem as tangible, because, you know, it's Northeast, people don't talk about it. Down South, it's open, it's out there. You're like, oh shit, it's way more real than I thought it was, you know?
It's shocking. And, you know, and that's where I do conventions all over the country. I did two Texas conventions last year at the end of the year. And it's a different world there, you know? I mean, people think differently, they act differently, they wear different clothes, they wear guns on their hips inside bars. It's weird for me.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think, go back to class for a second. There's a line in there I thought was so profound, and I want to kind of cover it a little bit. Michael asked his mother, what if he doesn't want to be Jewish anymore? Doesn't want to be Jewish. And I thought that was such a profound question. And I kind of wanted to kind of explore the impact of that question on the story that you have, and how important is that to the theme of your story, the idea of trying to walk away from your heritage, or wondering if you can step away from your heritage.
I think it's very central. Not it, like I said, you don't have the full book, but so you didn't see the conversation that that Michael had with the Zaid, where he talked about not wanting to be Jewish, and the Zaid responds is like, well, you know, when I was sitting in the Nazis' cage, having to eat dead rats to survive, I wasn't really fond of being Jewish either. you know what I mean? I mean,
right.
You know, I'm sure if you're in Dachau and you were living that way, you might have questioned, you know. I think there's, I've always been very pro-Israel, and I've gotten shit for that lately, which is weird to me. And I've always had a lot of Jewish friends and been very pro-Jewish because to me, it's a very, I like the fact that you're not, evangelical. You know what I mean? I mean, Judaism is more of it's a cultural thing. It's a religion, but it's a cultural thing. It's a group of people, and they're not looking to get everyone else to bang them over the head and force them to believe what they believe, like a lot of the evangelicals are. And I think that's the evangelical creed kind of drives me nuts, especially in tangent with the prosperity doctrine of these megachurches. You know, it just makes me question because they're not biblical. You know, I'm a self-proclaimed atheist and have been for over 30 years. But I was raised a right-wing Christian kid. And so I studied the Bible intensely. And I'm shocked how many times when I sit down and talk to people that they don't even know what the Bible says. I'm like, I can quote you chapter and verse. You know, right. I mean, and you're telling me you don't even know that's in the Bible? There was a, you know, and a lot of times they discount the Old Testament, which is the part that cracks me up. So you're saying it's the Bible, but because it's in the Old Testament, you can ignore it. I'm like, okay, I see how it is.
Only the sequel matters.
Oh, and you know, and the thing is, I didn't realize. I always thought the Torah was the entire Old Testament, but it's not. It's only the first five books, the ones of Moses, and I didn't know that until I just wrote this book recently.
Yeah,
I always thought the Torah was the entire Old Testament. I didn't realize it was a bunch of different books. And the thing is, we don't know. We're not. See, that's the thing. I think that. Judaism is sort of an inclusive culture by design. And I think what that does is it actually hurts you guys in the eyes of everyone else because people put on it what they want to put on it or what they think it is. And it's not really what it is. And if they knew what it was, they'd chill the fuck out.
Well, you know, kind of fun. My father used to tell me, he means a lot, but he used to tell me, because I'm also someone who identifies as an atheist. Even though, you know, both my parents are Jewish going all the way back. So, you know, it's definitely, you know, Jewish, culturally Jewish. I guess also sometimes they call it an ethnicity as well, Jewish, but whatever. And he would say that, you know, going back, you can say you're not Jewish, you can be an atheist all you want. But if this was Germany, you're a Jew. You know, I don't care. You can call yourself whatever the hell you want. You can walk away from it as much as you wish. You're a Jew. You know, in everyone's eyes who don't like you, that's what you are.
Well, the Nazis were shooting the children of male Jews with non-Jewish women. And isn't part of it that the mother has to be Jewish for you to be Jewish, right? At least in the generational way.
Right.
You know, the Nazis weren't paying attention to that. They were killing anyone that was a child of a male or female Jew. I mean, I laugh because it's not funny, but I do that nervously at times. But, you know, there's no distinction being made at that point.
Yeah. But there's a great book, and I had it. I'm trying to remember the name of the author, but it's a history book called Jewish Hitler's Hitler's Jewish Soldiers, about the Jews who fought for Hitler, and they go through all the history and how different rules were made over time. That even though they were a soldier for Hitler and they had Jewish, you know, Jewish parents, stuff like that, they still would be considered a Jew, and they, you know, how that standard changed over time, and it's fascinating. And the level of, you know, dislike and how specific they were about it is just like it's insane. People. They hang on to some weird ass lines in the saying about their hate, you know?
Well, the whole thing, you know, the Prague rabbi that created the Gollum myth, I was really fascinated to realize part of the reason why he did that is because in that time period, there was a group that just decided that they were going to spread lies about the Jews and say that they drank the blood of children. I don't know if you ever heard of that one.
Oh, yes, I have.
That was the one that, which is amazingly similar to the QAnon conspiracy about drinking children's blood.
Well, I'm sure that's where it comes from.
You know, I mean, so they've extrapolated it out to left-wing Christians, not just Jews.
The Clay People class, is that, are you going to be further examining? Like I said, I really wish I had the chance to read the whole issue, but is the story part of it a moral parable about some of this that we've been discussing?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think I can write without creating some level of that, because it's not, it's very hard for me to write just fluff, you know? I mean, even the swing book I write, I try to write that with some emotional, it's not just Hallmark stuff. It's more, this is some real emotional realities over the head. But the Colossus book for me was a labor of love. I enjoy, I've always written and taken on projects because I want to learn about it. Like for me, if people say write what you know, I've always said I want to write what I want to know. Hmm. And I knew I didn't know as much about Judaism as I thought I did. So I was able to do a deep dive and read some books and talk to some people. And I had a really good time doing it, you know. And, you know, it's interesting when you, because, you know, you run into, like, I have Jewish friends that I can't, you know, the people I think are, I can't stand them sometimes. And I, you know, it's just, they're people, you know,
I
don't know why people have to assume, oh, because you're X, Y, or Z, you know, you're sucking children's blood. And...
So you're because your book, you know, deals with some bullying and the history with Judaism, and you're writing based on a song Colossus by the Clay People. Did you have to check with them to see if certain ideas were approved by them, or did they step in and say, this idea you're going, you know, it's too controversial? Or was it basically, you do your thing, this is your story?
No, I pitched them the story and they did approve it. So they went through it and we had a couple discussions about it. Because I think the first conversation I had with them was like, the story is very dissimilar to the video that we did. Like they're not related at all. And I explained why I made the choices I did and they embraced it. So on that level, I have to say, I really enjoyed working with the band and with Epitome on this, because they did defer to me, which is unusual in these cases. Mm. I wrote for the Power Rangers TV series a couple seasons and done a lot of work for hire work in my lifetime. And that is not often afforded to work for hire writers.
So when is Colossus being released?
March 16th, it will be in stores everywhere.
That, like I said, the preview I got to read, it really is a, not only is it a great read, so but what I've been able to read, but the art is beautiful. I mean, they did a fantastic job with the artwork in the comic book.
That's Christian Dabari, who is one of my favorites. He did a book called Magdalena with Ryan Katie that we did a few years ago, and he did another book, a horror book for us, and I can't remember the title of it, but always just been a huge fan of his work. And when this got tossed to me, I thought of him immediately and asked him if he'd be willing to do it. He said yes. So, and we're working on another one now. So there's a follow-up. There's another project that we're working on together, but it's not Colossus.
Well, like I said, I look forward to being able to read the whole thing, or you can send me the PDF of it. I would love to read it.
I will send it to you tonight. I'll just look for it now.
Thank you so much, sir. And I also want to thank you so much for talking with me.
No worries. I'm happy to come on anytime.
The door is always open for you. So especially if you want to do more Colossus, come back and talk about that as well.
Well, I'm curious what you think of the full book. So like I said, I'm going to send it to you and all right, I don't have it. So I'm going to have to ask one of my guys to send it to me and then I'll forward it to you.
And also, I guess I should ask you as well, because eventually I am going to talk to Mr. Kaplan. If you could send me a preview of Metal Society, although I would like to take a look prior to that.
I don't think there is a preview yet.
Okay.
We have a trailer that he made, which is dropping on March 2nd, which I'll tell you what, I will share it with you on this, but don't tell anybody I showed it to you.
I won't.
You're not recording this, are you? This part?
I'll edit it out. It's fine.
Okay.
Tell you what, actually, let me just say, do the goodbye and then I'll stop the record.
Okay.
All right. So, Mr. Hawkins, thank you so much for coming on the show. The door is always open for you, and I greatly appreciate talking with you.
Thanks for having me, and thanks, everyone. Check out Colossus from the Clay People. Comes out March 16th for Amish Conference.